So this is our training nurses and other healthcare workers to serve cross-culturally on short-term missions. But of course, the very first thing that we're going to do is pray. Prayer is always a good place to start, right? I was born in the mountains there in California. Those are the Sierra mountains. So I always love verses that have to do with beauty of creation. I will look up to the heavens. Does my help come from there? My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. So let's pray, and then we'll get into the content for today. Oh, Lord, we just thank you. We thank you that you are the great creator, that you love each and every one of us. As we talk about ways to serve cross-culturally, Lord, help us to be reminded that we are created to glorify you. Not creation, although it's beautiful, Lord, and thank you for that, but we are created to glorify you in everything that we say and do. I thank you for all those that are here, Lord. May they just have open eyes and hearts and ears to whatever you would teach them, Lord, from you. It's not about me, Lord. It's about you. So thank you, and we praise you in Jesus' name. Amen.
Yeah.
All right. So, my experience. Who is this crazy lady standing up here in front of you? Well, PICU, CVICU. Any big PICU, CVICU nurses out in the audience? Maybe one or two, okay? I also did ECMO, transport, all the fun things. Got some of those as well. And then I did that for about 25 years and then kind of switched gears to more toward the community development, going into different communities, both locally and overseas, and then also able, I happen to teach at California Baptist University, which is in Southern California, great school, great nursing program. My colleague is here with me, Marion. So we get to take students overseas and serve. So for example, this last summer, I was in Bangladesh, which is that picture right there. So some students with some of the locals. We were able to do some health education there. So sometimes when we think about cross-cultural working, it doesn't look like you think it might. So here I have all this great ICU experience, and then you go someplace and it might look different, right? And so being flexible and understanding that that is part of God's plan, might not be your plan, but it might be his plan, is really important. So. So how many of you have traveled outside the U.S.? Raise your hand. Oh, yay. How many of you have lived overseas for maybe a year or less? Okay. How many of you are just here for this fun conference and you live overseas most of the year? Years and years. Okay, I know a few of you that. Okay. Just kind of gives me a sense of who's in the room, so thank you for that. This picture here, I have lots of pictures. I'm a visual learner, so I like to have lots of pictures. Helps me tell stories as well. This is in downtown Delhi, and as you can see, it looks a little bit different than downtown Louisville. And when we're thinking about working cross-culturally, though, it doesn't matter where we are. We can have cross-cultural experiences no matter where God puts us, right? Especially in our global world. So, of course, we have some objectives this time. We're going to focus on best practices because it's easy for us to go and be motivated to, yeah, I want to go serve somewhere. But then it's all about us and not about what we're supposed to be doing there. And so how can we best be the hands and feet of Jesus? And then, of course, look at that biblical basis for what it is that we're doing. Again, echoing some of the things that have already been shared at plenaries and breakouts that you guys might have been to. And then what are some good strategies that are effective? So here's a picture from Uganda. And in Uganda, it was interesting. Being a PICU nurse, I was able to start IVs pretty easily. I got really good at it. I'm the one that would start IVs in random places. Where's the most random place somebody has started an IV? In here. Shout it out. Head, you can see that here. Where else? Anybody else? Okay, bottom area. Wherever there's a vein, right? So abdomen, there was a little guy that had some defects, and so he had, you know, there's, look at your hand, there's this great vein right there. That's where his IV ended up. All kinds of interesting places. Because, again, we have to do what we can, no matter where God puts us. But when we think about cultures around the world, and here in our backyard, they all have different worldviews, and we're going to kind of drill down into that and what those behaviors are that are related to what do they think about birth and death, and what are some of the practices around that? And I have a friend in the room who's doing some research in that very area. And so what we're going to also look at is looking at cultural humility, because we all need to come in that servant attitude as we approach other people with openness, compassion that was just shared about in that plenary, and with that love of Jesus. So we really need to start with appreciating what it is that we're walking into, right? That might be a little bit different than we expect. So how we integrate that into our care is important. We need to show honor. We need to show respect. That is not a kidney patient in room 5. That is a fellow image bearer of God in room 5 who happens to have kidney disease, right? So switching our mindset to that, when we're trained as nurses and other healthcare providers, we're trained in that medical model. That is a kidney patient. Right? But we need to shift our way of thinking and walk into that room with a different mindset. So when we think about it as nurses and other healthcare providers, we are also called to follow Jesus. We're called to make disciples. And we'll get to the Matthew 28 verse that y'all might be familiar with. But that means that we put together our discipline with our faith. They aren't separate. We don't put our faith up on a shelf and just let it sit there. And so that really is important as we think about this. And we have extra tools in our toolbox as healthcare providers, whatever our level or whatever our training is, to meet the needs of that fellow image bearer of God. I'm going to be talking a little bit about shalom. And for those of you that aren't familiar, some of you think, oh, that word means peace. Well, it means so much more than that. The meaning of shalom is right relationship with God and right relationship with other people. And it includes aspects of Micah 6:8, justice, mercy, wholeness, and things we probably don't always think about when we're working with our patients. So, shalom, and this is from a quotation. Shalom means just relationship, so there's that justice piece. Living justice, justly and experiencing justice, harmonious relationships, enjoyable relationships. That's one of the reasons COVID was so hard. We're created to be in community. And when we weren't able to do that, that really impacted us because we're created in that way. It means belonging to that authentic community, whatever that looks like for each one of you. And if you're not plugged into a church, I would recommend that you get plugged into a small group of some kind, because that's where you're going to find that community. And that is really important as we learn and grow about who we are and who God is. Justice, harmony, enjoyment of God, self, and others. This is the shalom that Jesus brings. In the New Testament, the word that's there is Irene, and it's very similar meaning in that area. So when we think about shalom and serving are the people that God puts in front of us, that really is important. So what do you guys see in this picture? Shout out some things. What do you see?
Tranquility.
What else?
A man.
Mountains. Colors, reflection, water.
Barriers.
Did you say barriers?
A bridge.
Okay. Good.
Boats.
Yes.
Bots.
Yes. So for some, when you look at this picture, you think, oh, there's some adventure, right? Or, I just want to be out there. Someone said tranquility. Ah. This looks peaceful, tranquil, right? Does God call us to a place of tranquility? Nope, not so much. So what is your motivation? So thinking about when you want to serve, whatever that looks like, whether you start with short-term and those that have perhaps not done short-term and are thinking about long-term, short-term is a great way to be that bridge, if you will, to going long-term and seeing if what God has for you. But why go? Is it just to get that photo op with the statue in Brazil? Is it they had this fun place that's not there anymore in Chiang Mai where you could get some fun pictures and have some great experiences? Well, according to Greg Seeger, who happens to be here as one of the exhibitors, he wrote the book When Healthcare Hurts. He has free copies. He told me to tell you to come get a free copy. He has 200 of them, so you've been commissioned to go get one. But in a person's eagerness, he talks about, to do good, they can destabilize health systems, undermine the work of local providers, and cause resentment. He talks a little bit about certain areas. I think about Haiti, for example. They keep having disaster after disaster after disaster. And I'm not saying don't go there, but go there in partnership with an organization. Because what ended up happening initially was people were just going from their church, we're going to go save Haiti. We're going to go do stuff for Haiti. And they'd go and they'd set up medical clinics. And a mile to 3 miles down the road, there was another health clinic for the nationals. And then people wouldn't go there because they waited for the foreigners to come and do the health care. And it destabilized the economy of the locals. So it really is important when we think about, and I'm jumping ahead just a little bit to strategies, but you really need to be intentional about partnering with people that are already there. So the biblical basis, I did mention that we would talk a little bit about that. And Imago Dei, we are all created in the image of God. We all have inherent dignity and worth. And again, what was shared in the plenary about marginalized people, people that feel othered, people that are discriminated against for whatever reason, we have devalued those people for whatever reason. And so we know that, again, people want that genuine right relationship and peace. Jesus came that all people may have life and have it abundantly, right? Not just us, not just select few. And what is interesting in that is the Missio Dei. What's the mission of God? We get to be part of his plan of purpose. Again, the plenary speaker just kind of talked a little bit about that. We get to proclaim, we get to witness to his love in both what we do and what we say. And there's a cloud of witnesses. I believe she quoted that scripture as well, right? There's people watching, people that we might not even know are watching. And so what it says, of course, in Luke 10 is go and do likewise. Go and do. Do you guys know that the Good Samaritan story is a cross-cultural story?
Yes.
Right? So they, Samaritans and Jews did not get along. Yep. And for that person to stop and take care of someone from another culture that were basically enemies was huge. Right? So we need to do the same. Go and do likewise is what it says at the end of that particular passage. And Jesus wants us to be caught up in his work. His work is going on all around us. Again, the plenary was talking. There's stuff going on all around us. It reminds me of Acts 1:8. We have been given power in our Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the ends of the earth. Some of you are going to work or are working in the ends of the earth. Some of you are going to stay in your Jerusalem. And that's okay. Wherever it is that you are doing God's work. So when we think about short-term missions, you want to be transformative. You want to learn from each other, not just come in as, oh, I'm the expert, I'm the person that knows stuff. Because then you can grow, you can engage with each other and accomplish way more than you could ever do alone. And again, that's from Greg's book as well. So our living God is a missionary God. I don't know if you guys are aware of this. Anybody taken Perspectives in here, the Perspectives course? So in Perspectives, it's a great course that talks about this very idea that God called Abram out of a polytheistic society and said, I choose you. You are going to be a blessing to those that come after you. And so from the very beginning in Genesis, God was saying, go and be a light to the people around you. Now, the Israelites kind of wandered for a while, didn't maybe follow what Jesus or what God had told them to do. And so then we fast forward to the New Testament and we have a new command, right, and new covenants to fulfill. But he did say, I will make your name great among all the nations and you will be a blessing. So that for us is, I am blessed to be a blessing. You are blessed to be a blessing to whomever God puts in your path. Right? It isn't about the task. How many of you are in school still? Raise your hand. Okay. You're learning tasks, learning how to do stuff, right? It's important to know that task, but it's more than that. It's more than the task. And yes, you have to get all your stuff done on time, especially the nurses have to give their meds on time. They have to do the cares and everything on time, but that's a person, and we are blessed to be a blessing to every person that God puts in our path, again, wherever we might be working. So that's so important to think about. In Matthew 28, 18 to 20, which you might be, of course, familiar with, it says, all authority, that's all God's authority, in heaven and earth has been given to me. Therefore, remember that the therefore is there for a reason? You guys heard that? Yeah. So therefore, go and make disciples. It doesn't say preachers, go make disciples. It doesn't say evangelists, go make disciples. It says go make disciples. That's us too. Of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. So there's a great book. Chuck Fielding might be here. I'm not sure. He wrote a book, Preach and Heal, and it talks about the preachers are over here and the healers are over here, and we sometimes think that they're separate, but they really go hand in hand. Amen. Jesus healed and preached. It wasn't separate. It was together. And so we should not be compartmentalizing those things. They go together, whatever it is that we are doing. So thinking about that in that verse, in that part of Matthew, it's in the in the verse 19, it says all nations, all peoples, all ethno-linguistic people groups is what that is pointing to. So, circling back to our title, what does good training look like? Well, that's a great question. Prayer, right? Super important. Discipleship, culture. If you do cross cultures, you're going to experience culture shock and some of these other areas. I'm going to go down into each of these different areas and talk a little bit more about those. So prayer. Spiritual warfare is real. Some of you might have experienced that before coming here. Maybe the enemy didn't want you to come to this conference. But we have the tools that we need in our toolbox. And it always starts with prayer. Some of you might be trying to figure out, what is it that my next steps are? Where does the Lord want me to go? Start with prayer. Always start with prayer. And so I think about spiritual warfare. I think about things that happen in our life that are totally unexpected. So a year ago, I was traveling and I got a phone call, or actually a text from my husband that said, the house is on fire. And I'm like, huh? What? You're kidding, right? I'm thinking, because I've got a bunch of kids living with me and their kids, you just mean that the kids are rowdy right now? No, the house was on fire. And so I said, do I need to come home? I was actually on my way to a funeral with my uncle. And he said, no, go to the funeral. There's nothing you can do here. And then I went home and dealt with all the things. I was supposed to leave for Bangladesh in like a couple weeks. And it was, okay, Lord, am I still supposed to go and serve in Bangladesh because of this? Everybody thankfully got out of my house okay, even the two dogs. And everything was fine. It's just stuff. But it did feel like the enemy was trying to prevent me from going. I went. Enemy, you do not have any power over me. And the reason that I put this particular verse in there is, first, of course, when that happened, I went to Job and kind of read some of Job, and he never cursed the Lord in his situation when things were going a little sideways for him, right? And then I also went to Ephesians because I needed to stand firm. Do you know that whole passage, if I had the whole passage up there? It says stand firm four times. I needed to stand firm and not let the enemy get in my way of whatever it was that the Lord wanted me to do. And I had never been to Bangladesh before, and I was so blessed. You know, you kind of go, well, I'm going to go do this task. And then, no, I was blessed by going way more than anything I might have brought there. And so that really is important to think about with spiritual warfare. So we think about Jesus modeled that spiritual discipline of praying. He went and he was alone sometimes, meditating on scripture, fellowship sometimes is part of that as well. And he expected his people to also meditate on the word and follow it. Blessed are those who hear the word and obey. So other ways to fight that battle we know is by serving, giving to the vulnerable. because it takes our mind off of whatever it is that's going on with us, using those gifts and talents that the Lord has given us, but remembering to rest, find balance. You younger generation peoples are way better at doing that than this old lady up here, but finding balance in the midst of that so that you don't get tired. You can't pour from an empty cup. And so being filled again with the Holy Spirit is so important. Each of us must be immersed in all the spiritual disciplines, of course, prayer being one of them, if we're going to be able to fight that good fight and take that gospel to the unreached people, all the tribes, tongues, and nations from Revelation 7:9. And we know how the story ends. Let me talk to you also about a story that occurred in India. I might have shared this last year when I shared here, but we were in India, and there was a gal. We use the Che model. Some of you might be familiar with Che. It's community health evangelism. You tell stories from the Bible. We would also do henna storytelling, so we would draw the pictures of the story on people's arms, and then they take it back into their community areas, and they tell the story, Bible stories, to their friends, and that's a way to use henna as storytelling. So we were telling the story of the bleeding woman and how God had healed her, and she had just reached out, you know, with her hands to be healed. And a lady came up to us afterwards, and she said, I always get emotional. She said, I'm that woman. I've been bleeding for years and years. And we weren't doing a health clinic or anything. We had nothing with us except prayer. Amen. We prayed over her. And then later came to find out that she was healed. That was totally the Lord. We had literally looked at each other and thought, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? Oh, well, duh, we can pray, right? So we prayed over her, and the Lord healed her. So we don't always realize, and especially on short term, you might not hear those fun stories that occur, but we did hear later that that had occurred. And God used that woman in mighty, mighty ways, beyond what we could ever imagine or dream of. It had nothing to do with an intervention, a surgery. It was prayer. So when we think about stories, this is, I think, on that trip in India. What do you guys think? Why do you think stories are so effective? Throw some ideas out there. I'm telling stories because it's personal. Absolutely. Relatable. Yeah. So when we tell stories, or when we listen to our patients' stories, or the people in front of us, when we listen to their stories, we have just validated that they are a fellow image bearer of God. It is so easy, again, no matter where we're serving, to just get caught up in the tasks. I've got to get my stuff done. Checklist, checklist, checklist. Right? We have SBAR. We have all the fun things that we're supposed to be doing. And they're important. Don't get me wrong. I teach a quality improvement class for doctoral students. It's important. However, when I stop for a moment and listen to those stories, I hear things that perhaps I need to know. Can't tell you as a PICU nurse how many times that the family would say, the kiddo was on the floor, and the mom would say, nobody listened to me. And the kid's crashing and we're coding that patient. Nobody listened to me. I told them that something wasn't right. We've got to listen to our patients, to those that God puts in front of us. Listening to their stories is so important. Which ties into discipleship. So that was the next bullet point on our strategies. So engaging people around us in discipleship and or mentoring. In my perspective, mentoring might be a little bit different. Mentoring might be more toward apprenticeship, maybe more toward a job type of thing. Discipleship is that one-on-one, living life together, in the Word together, that is so important, right? And there can be overlap because you could be also mentoring in a position for a job as well. But it's a journey. It's a spiritual growth journey. So I get to take students. I am leaving next Tuesday for Thailand with some students. We get to serve there. And I get to pour into and walk alongside them on this journey for a brief period of time. So it's about discipleship. It isn't about, oh, yay, we get to go to Thailand, because everybody in here was like, ooh, Thailand.
They have really good food.
Yes, they do. It's way better over there than it is here. We get to see elephants. Yeah, maybe. But we get to show the love of Jesus to people in hill tribes that don't know who Jesus is. That's what we get to do. No matter what the task is, that's what we're doing the whole time. So that's really important when we think about that. And Jesus told us to make disciples in all nations, as I've mentioned. Some examples, you guys are probably familiar with these examples as well. Moses and Joshua, right? Eli and Samuel. Elijah and Elisha. So many more examples. Jesus and his disciples. So what is our purpose? And I've mentioned this as well. It's to glorify him. That's why we were created. We were created to glorify him. And he created people to glorify him so that believers are to present their bodies as a living sacrifice. Everything that we do is a form of worship. Whatever conversation we're having. So we get to use those gifts and talents that God has given us in the training to come alongside the vulnerable, the lost. Again, exactly what the plenary speaker was talking about. In the same way that Jesus did, we get to do that. He touched the untouchables. For those that were in the plenary last night, he talked about caste system and he talked about untouchables. So in India, they do still have that caste system, although they'll deny it, but they do. And we were in a remote area outside Delhi, and it was called the Seva Ashram. It's a house for the destitute, very similar to places that Mother Teresa would work. And they would literally scoop up people off the side of the road that were dying and bring them there, share the gospel with them, and if they survived, would rehabilitate them, give them a job, or teach them a job so that they could then go out and fend for themselves, so to speak, and make a living afterwards if they survived. So there was a gal there and lots of TB. That was like the main thing that we were dealing with was TB. So we got there. We were doing TB intervention. And then the girls that I were with, the students that I brought with me, there were three young girls because there was a mom. She was off to the side. She had her mask on. She sat and she just watched us all week long that we were there. And my team was scooping up the three young girls and just showering them with love and just having fun with them, playing games with them. And at the end of the week, the mom is sitting over there and tears are just running down her face. And she said to the field worker, the long-term worker, "Why have they been touching my children? Nobody has ever touched my children before." We really don't understand that as well here. Yes, we have marginalized peoples, and that's we're going to talk a little bit about culture and what that looks like. But wow, they were literally untouchable. But we showed the love of Jesus, and that was more impactful than anything else that we could have done for that particular situation. So, talking about the training, we've talked about prayer, we've talked about discipleship, let's talk a little bit about that cultural training and how important it is before you go, because it can mess you up a little bit when you're not prepared to go to those cross-cultural situations. So what does culture mean? What do you guys think? Throw that out there. What does culture mean? Come on, I know it's early.
Beliefs.
Sorry?
Beliefs.
Absolutely, includes beliefs. What else?
Tradition.
Yes.
Community.
Sorry?
Community.
Community, absolutely.
Societal norms.
Yeah. So sometimes we have this idea that culture just means ethnicity. It means way, way more than that, right? So good, important content. So why is it important to study that? And why would I not want to ask the fish that lives in that environment? It's the only thing he knows, right? So it's sometimes hard for us living in a certain culture to understand how to articulate what that is, right? So hence the quote there, which I think is really important. He's never lived outside that environment, But what happens when you think about your own situation, when things in your life change, when, and this is a quote from a blog that I found, and she's working overseas, and she says, what happens when everything in your life changes? So she's now overseas. When the tea is no longer sweet, but hot with a drop of milk. When the chips are actually fries and crisps are chips, you can probably guess where she might be. When you drive on the left side of the road and everything is generally a little older, smaller, shorter. I have that problem with small doorways, right? And the sun rarely shines. Sure, I knew it was. I was from the South. I knew culture was different in different places. I even knew that not everyone enjoyed a pound of sugar and some lemon in their ice cold tea. Sweet tea, yeah. But what I didn't know is how many tiny, inconspicuous things would change. And I'm learning that my way is not always right. It's not wrong. It's just different. That's the key takeaway if you think of nothing else from the culture piece. It's not wrong. It's just different, right? So, and as she was talking, she learned more and more about the people around her. I unknowingly learned more about myself. Like the fish, I knew nothing about my own environment until I saw something different. God has uniquely made each and every one of us, and as I embark on this journey of discovering myself and others, I am able to see the beauty of His creation. And then a side note, but I really can't get over the fact that they drive on the wrong side of the road. Because it's a daily struggle to not get hit by oncoming traffic when crossing the street because of my inability to look the right way, right? So if you're used to traffic being on a certain side in Thailand, it's on the opposite side from here. So I always have to look and then go, oh, wait, which way are they coming? So it is something a little bit different. It's not wrong. It's just different. So culture is learned. So if, for example, I adopt someone from another ethnic background or another region, they're going to learn about my culture, right? So it's learned, it's transmitted across generations. There's spoken bits and unspoken parts of our culture. There's some things that are visible, some that are invisible, but it's changing all the time. And here's the main thing, it governs actions and decisions. So this particular picture is a Lua village in northern Thailand, and we were prayer walking through the village, and almost everybody, a lot of Asian cultures are very hospitable. They'll invite you in, offer tea and or snacks, whatever they might have. And so we would go up the stairs into these homes, but in this particular home, there was a lady at the top of the stairs, and she was doing this with a stick. And she did not want us to come in. Everybody else had been very welcoming and open. She did not want us in her home. In this particular village, they will say when believers come in that Jesus' spirit is too strong. What? They live in a spiritual realm of animism. They worship spirits. They are afraid of the spirits. They offer things to spirits. And she was saying in her pounding of her stick, that your Jesus spirit is rattling me. And it turns out she was a spirit doctor, healer type person for that particular village. Yeah, our Jesus spirit was rattling her cage just a little bit. I told the students, keep on praying, keep on singing, it's okay. And I don't know if any of you have had those types of experiences where the enemy tries to just, and I'm going down a little bunny trail thinking about this house, but thinking about, I was in a Hindu temple, and we were singing praise songs lightly, under our breath a little bit, maybe a little louder, and I felt like the enemy tried to bind my lips, literally. Like, I couldn't, for a moment, I couldn't say or sing anything, and I said, prayer, my God is bigger than this. So thinking about that as we think about culture and crossing cultures and what are good strategies, prayer, always coming back to prayer. My God is bigger than this situation. Whatever this is, my God is bigger. And I started singing again. God is good. But when we, sorry?
All the time.
All the time. Thank you. Yes. So, yeah. So I would challenge you to think about every encounter can be a cross-cultural encounter, whether you're here in the States or you're overseas somewhere. Because just because a person lives next door to you, they might not have the same values, traditions, you guys brought that up. They might not have the same belief system that you do, right? So we need to be mindful of that, that not everybody has that same perspective. And don't assume that they do just because they grew up in your neighborhood and maybe even go to your church. We need to be very careful that we're not making assumptions in general anyway. So encouraging people to be active in their story, listening to their story, is part of that as well. So some of the things that this relates to makes me think about, are the patients or the people that you're interacting with, are they going to seek care from a quote-unquote Western provider? Or are they going to go to that healer, spiritualist, whatever the label is within their society first? And that happens here as well. Are they going to go and drink those teas and do those herbal remedies and or whatever before they come to you? And then are they going to be sicker because they waited a little bit longer? Maybe. But really understanding that is important as well. How they behave when they're sick? Are they wailing with pain? Are they very stoic? A lot of the Buddhist faith tradition, the idea is that you're supposed to meditate and rise above suffering, and other faith traditions as well. So they might be very stoic. They might not ask you for that pain medication because of that. So understanding that, who's expected to care for people? So the story last night when he said that he had to light the fire to cremate his father, the eldest son in the Hindu faith tradition is responsible for funeral arrangements and taking care of things. That's part of their faith tradition. So who is in charge, if you will? Whose role is it? Are they collective in their way of thinking? Are they individual? Here in the U.S., we're very individualistic. I have the right to make my own decisions, right? But in other cultures, it might be that the head of the household makes decisions. It might be that a shaman makes those decisions, right? So we need to be mindful of that. I know you can't see this very well. And by the way, this PowerPoint is posted on the website, as is the handout for you guys. So I know you can't see the iceberg too well, but what's up there that's visible? What do you guys see that's visible with your magnifying glass? Yeah. So age, clothing, gender, language. These are the things that we see when a patient or a person that we are interacting with comes to us. What are some of the things buried way down and less visible? Personal beliefs, worldview. Who's in charge? So there's role situations as well. Assumptions, all kinds of stuff. So culture influences every decision that that patient or that person is making. And there's so much that we don't see below. So again, the visible and the invisible piece, that outside piece is visible. The secondary level, so that less visible piece, might be known by the people in that culture, but they might not be known to us, right? And it's not until we either live with people or ask a lot of really good questions that we find out a little bit more. But this verse reminds me from 1 Peter, clothe yourselves with humility, because God opposes the proud but shows favor to the humble. So it's easy for us to come in and we see stuff and we judge. Unconscious, and we'll talk a little bit about implicit bias as well. So it starts with cultural self-assessment. What are my attitudes? That's what's really important. I do teach a culture class, you can probably tell. Oh, by the way, I did say I teach at CBU, right? So we talk about this, about being able to assess what are my attitudes, what are my values and beliefs, and then checking some of those at the door. Now, my love, care, compassion for all people, that I bring with me into the room. But the judging that they're wrong, that they're bad because of their choices, we all know that there's choices people make, and then there's consequences to those choices, right? Think about my own kids. I have 3 grown kids, 8 grandkids. I'm blessed. My kids have made some choices, and there's been some consequences, but I love them anyway, right? And we can do that same thing with our own self-assessment. It ties back to why do you want to go? If you're thinking about going overseas for short-term or long-term, why do you want to go? What's your motivation? Are you going to fix, quote-unquote, fix people? Because as a pastor in Kenya said, please don't come to fix us. We have been fixed so many times, we're a real mess now. And that's in Greg Seeger's book as well. Because it's personal and it's professional. So what are some culturally determined factors? And I'm going to do a little assessment with you guys in just a minute on some of your perspectives, hence the little handout. But what would you think would be some culturally determined factors? Any ideas? Sorry? Living conditions. Yep, that's in Bangladesh, that particular picture.
Geography.
What else?
Mindset.
Sorry?
Mindset.
Mindset? Yeah, absolutely. So aspects of those, so the geography, where you're going, what is norm there or normative, and some of these categories as well. How many of you are like, I get there early? I saw some of you in here. Raise your hand if you are that. I get here early all the time. Okay. What about those of you that you just kind of slide in right when it's on time? Okay, thank you for being honest. How about some that, okay, I'll get there 10, 15, maybe 20 minutes late? Awesome, thank you for being honest as well. So time means different things in different areas, right? So in our Western biomedical model, we say you have an appointment at 2. You need to come to your appointment at 2. But having been overseas numerous times, we're in India, we're going to do a women's health clinic, and we said, okay, it's going to start at 3 o'clock. Well, let's see, about 4 o'clock. Yep, nope, nobody's here yet. Well, come to find out, they had to wait for their kids to get home from school, they had to get dinner started, and they started strolling in close to 6 o'clock. Time means something different in other cultures. In other cultures, relationships are more important than our concept of time. So understanding that if you are going to go and serve in a cross-cultural context is really helpful. We will say, literally, we're on Thailand time, we're on Uganda time, we're on Bangladesh time, which is different than my perception of what time is. And that's okay. And we need to sometimes let go of some of our Western thoughts. Also, you know, we have this perfect plan of what we're going to do when we get there. Toss it out the window. It will most likely be different than what you think. Space. Put your hands out in front of you about this far. Okay, good. Most of us in a Western context, that's as close as we want people to be when we're having a conversation. If people start getting a little bit closer, what do? Back off, step back a little bit. Other cultures, not so much. They're very close to each other. Now, if you're working in the hospital setting, you know those rooms can sometimes be pretty close. You're trying to maneuver around the bed or what have you. But you get into a situation with space, and it starts to feel a little uncomfortable. And so that's important to understand that it might look different in other places. Gestures. So thinking about, I don't have a bunch of slides on this, but I thought about it. So there's certain things that we do that are not okay in other countries. How many of you, you use your little emoji? I see people nodding. There's certain cultures that is a sexual, has a sexual connotation. How many of you do the peace sign? That's probably not as common in your younger generation. But if you turn it around, that is also a sexual sign in certain countries. So understanding before you go to a certain place, what is okay and what is not okay. Let's see. Yeah, eye contact is on there. That's part of it too. Greetings. So when we go to Thailand, for example, the correct way to greet people is not to shake hands, but to do what's called the Y, W-A-I. And you put your hands in the front. You might have seen people do this before in other places, too. They do it sometimes in Indonesia, Malaysia. But you greet somebody by putting your hands together, and you would bow, and you would say, Sawadika. Now, depending on where you put your hands in front of your body determines the status of the person that you're greeting. So I've had littles come to me because I'm old, and they'll do this. Their hands are way up here, and they are bowing like that. So cute. Please don't do that. But it's part of their culture. I'm an elder, and they are respecting me. So not knowing sometimes another person's status, for me, I tend to just keep my hands like right about here. Then I'm hopefully not offending anyone. But gestures, greetings are important, or people bowing. We were saying when we were in Thailand during COVID, we should be all greeting each other this way because then we're not touching people's hands, right, for that infectious piece. Posture and how we interact. We're trained in our Western biomedical model to go in and, hi, my name is Rebecca. I'm going to be your nurse today. And we expect that patient to be looking at us in the eye. Well, in many, many cultures, looking someone in the eye is disrespectful. I'm looking down because I'm showing you honor and respect. And in certain cultures, as a female, if I look at a male in the eyes, that's a come on, a sexual come on. So I need to be very careful as a female, especially in Muslim contexts. When we were in Bangladesh, we did dress in the traditional clothing, and we covered our hair the whole time we were out. And I was very careful with how I interacted with males because of the cultural differences. So being aware of that is really important as well. And sometimes it's okay to be quiet, and sometimes it's okay to have those 1,000 cups of tea. So what in our, there's a book called 1,000 Cups of Tea. I forget the guy's name. But when we think about interacting with people, especially if you're in a hospitable area where you're going to be required to take off your shoes when you first go in and they're going to offer you tea and or other things, we also need to be mindful that they might have used some of their last bits of money to buy that for you. And to refuse would be offensive. And so we need to be very careful. We have those conversations before we go overseas. If someone offers you, do your very best to accept what is being offered, because that is part of their gift of hospitality, which we don't necessarily do as well here in the U.S. So being mindful of that, facial expressions, all of these things are really part of that cultural communication. And another couple things would be language. It's really important to learn language if you do go overseas and end up staying there long term, because with language, you understand nuances in the culture. There's culture tied into language. And then you learn a little bit more about the do's and don'ts and that kind of thing as well. So something to think about. So as I said, the culture influences healthcare decision making in a lot of ways. So fatalism, do you guys know what that means? So it's fate, it's karma, what goes around comes around kind of thinking, like was shared last evening as well. So if that person is sick, they might think they deserve to be sick. And if they believe in spirits or curses, they might believe that they are deserve to be sick because of a curse, because of another type of thing that happened in their life. So being mindful of that is important as well. Individualism, I mentioned that with our individualistic society here in the U.S. We think that all of our patients, and we're taught, have autonomy and should be able to make decisions. And in cross-cultural contexts, even here, that sometimes might be challenged a little bit, and it can be hard to navigate that. Working in the CVICU, we took care of a lot of congenital heart defect patients, and we had a kiddo that came over, tons of drips, not doing well, dad's there, he was from an Arab majority country, and mom hadn't come over yet, she was still recovering from delivery, and so baby had gone to surgery, come back, 15 drips on the ventilator, all the things, and mom was going to come over later in the day, and he said, don't tell her anything. And we all kind of go, oh, but she has a right to know. So what you do then, and some of you might have encountered this, is you defer to that dad. He's in charge of that family unit. And so I stayed in the room, and then if mom had any questions, I would think as a mom it would be pretty apparent that that little one was not doing well. There's a ventilator and 15 drips there. but allowing for that cultural difference, for that family member to be the one to talk through what was going on, was huge in that situation. So again, that can happen even here. We don't have to be over there somewhere. The idea of linear versus circular thinking. The circular thinking, think about reincarnation, right? Like was shared last night, thinking about, well, I can come back again in another life and perhaps be something different, something better. And it also has to do with, in some cultures, they'll tell stories and they keep coming back to the main point. So especially in sermons in certain countries in Africa, they'll tell a story and then they'll talk about the message, but they'll go off at what seems like in our mind a tangent, but then they come back to the central idea. It's like a flower petal design is what it's called. And then they go off on another little story and then they come back. And it's very circular, a different way. It's not very linear. We have a way of, in our Western culture, to be like, step A, step B, tell me what the steps are. I'm good. And we're very linear in that. And from a biblical perspective, we're also very linear in our thinking. Genesis to Revelation, right? It's a continuum. We're all somewhere along that journey in our life. So circular thinking is a lot different. But again, if you're going into a cross-cultural context, that might be the norm for the way that they approach life. And then what's normal versus abnormal? How do you guys define health? What would you say? Question, answer time again. What does health mean?
State of wellness.
State of wellness. Were you going to say something?
How you're doing.
How you're doing. Okay. We all know the World Health Organization has definitions, and all of those organizations that you might be working for and with have definitions of what is health. But what is abnormal health? Depends on how you define health. Right? So I'll give you an example of that, personal example again, telling stories, that's what I do. So my husband was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis when he was 30, and he still is able to work, thank you Jesus. He uses a walker for like a short distance, but anything beyond that, he has to use a scooter. Now, if you were to ask him, how do you define health? Are you healthy?
Yes.
He would say yes. He has a potentially life-limiting illness. Right? But he would say he's healthy. Same thing with sometimes in overseas contexts, you'll go and they'll say, oh, they just have a little bit of diarrhea. That's normal. It's because of the water they're drinking. It's because of infection, parasites, all kinds of fun things. But for them, that might be what they consider normal. We all have that. Well, yes, looking at the water source that you might be drinking out of, I could see why you would think that is normal, right? So we need to be mindful of what is normal, what is not normal, what is it that the people in that particular area think of in that way. Does that make sense? So this is another category of culture. Some of you, again, might be familiar with this. People in the world living in this balance. There's our culture here in the U.S. We're more of the guilt innocence. We're innocent until proven guilty, right, in our Western culture. But in other cultures, there's a shame honor is the way that they live, or fear power. So the culture where I was talking about walking through the Lua village and the woman was shaking her stick at us, that's a fear power society. They live in fear. They honor their ancestors and spirits. So many Asian cultures embracing Islam also would think more toward the honor shame, like you would shame me if you did X, Y, and Z, or you will shame, bring shame on the family. And so really important to understand that. And then the animistic cultures, the ones that believe in spirits, again, live more in this idea of manipulating the powers that be in order to stay in right relationship with spirits. And I'll give you another example of a spiritual encounter. So in that same Lua village, there were no believers at first. It was a little teeny tiny road to get in. And eventually some nationals went in and were sharing the gospel, and a few people came to know Jesus. And they more and more people were meeting in one home. So up in those little homes where you go up the little stairs, which are really more like a ladder, to get into those homes. And the people in the village were upset. They wanted the believers to leave. They wanted them to move away out of the village. And so they went to the shaman and they said, do something to get rid of those believers. They don't belong here. They don't believe the same things that we do anymore. Get rid of them. So reportedly, the shaman did some spells and sent spirits over to that home to try to scare away the believers. But then the spirits reportedly came back to the shaman and then told the shaman that we can't get past the three men in white on the stairs. The middle man has a beard. And they came back and tormented the shaman instead. So when we think again about spiritual warfare, when we think about this power balance, people live in that fear. And they'll put offerings out on spirit houses and or other ways to minimize and live within that fear culture. So it really is important, if that's an area that you're going into, to understand what it is that is going on. So what most long-term people say is and report back is, if you can really understand guilt, shame, and fear, then that's a great starting point. And then understanding those concepts also helps you understand why they're putting the offerings out there and what those differences are in that situation. This is my friend Muscles. Yes, we call him Muscles. That's not his real name because his other name is too hard to say. But we had a snake that was coming in, and I'll talk a little bit more about safety and that kind of thing. But thinking about redemptive analogies. Do you guys know what those are? Anybody know what a redemptive analogy is? Yes, I saw that hand.
There are scripture and history and traditions that point toward Christ's redemption, and belief that every culture or most cultures or many cultures have something within that culture that's already present that is gives us a clue or a light or a head start in understanding the redemptive love. Intervention.
Okay. Thank you. You want to come up here now and you can do the rest of the lesson. So, yes. Don Richardson, you'll see his information, a little bit of it anyway, right there. He wrote a couple great books on this idea of redemptive analogies. Every single culture that he's encountered, he said maybe one or two where it was a struggle, there's some kind of a bridge to the gospel within that culture that points to Jesus. And they're called redemptive analogies. So last night he talked about building bridges, and this is one way to build bridges, is find the redemptive analogy within that culture. And so one of the books he wrote is called The Peace Child. And it talks about he was in New Guinea, and there were two warring clans, if you will. They were happened to be cannibals, and when they first started going there. And so they would fight, and whoever would win would eat the other group, I suppose. But what they realized as they were warring was they were killing each other off, and there would be no one left to carry on their line. So they came up with an idea, if this tribal king or leader would trade their firstborn with the other tribal group's leader, that was called the peace child. And so they would trade children, and those children would be raised in the other culture, so they stopped warring with each other. And so isn't that an interesting connection or segue to Jesus as the peace child? And so he was able to use their cultural story to build a bridge to the gospel. So within all cultures around the world, pretty much you can find that redemptive analogy. And thank you for sharing that. So because I'm a professor, can't help myself. There's a question and answer. Okay, is the following statement true or false? Methods, rules, guidelines, and patterns of behavior about food. Yes, I'm a food. Foodie. Food practices can be described as culture specific. How many say true? Raise your hand. Making sure you're still awake. Yes. How many of you say false? Anybody? All right. Absolutely. So food is cultural universal. Now, if you're working in the hospital setting, what's one of the first things we take away from people? Food. We've made them NPO. We also take away their clothes. Okay. There's dignity, shame. We've taken away clothes and food. Some things that are really important in certain cultures. So understanding that is important. But then look at the bottom of that slide. It says, considered what is considered edible. So that snake, we ate that snake that Muscles was holding. What are some fun things you guys might have eaten that are outside the box? Anybody else?
Locust
Any bugs?
The bugs in Uganda.
Were they grubs or were they?
Like the locusts.
The locusts, yeah. Termites. So we had a termite swarm in Thailand. We had termites the next day. Grubs, worms. Again, maybe that's the only source of protein in that particular cultural group. So thinking about that, what's edible, and then who prepares, who eats that, and then where do you sit? And who gets the first portion of food in that particular group as well? So when I was in China as the professor, I always was put at the head of the table because I was the honored guest. So we don't often think about that as much in our culture here in the U.S. So being aware of that is important. So food is culturally interwoven into what's going on. So you'll notice in this picture, if you can see it, that was our breakfast in Bangladesh. So there were things that were cultural types of foods, but they also brought us some American things, like some eggs. But there was mango, which is always much better overseas. Bananas, much better overseas. And then some other items that we would perhaps, depending on our background, not be eating or thinking about. Naan, of course, is always delicious, no matter where you are. But we think about what's the meaning behind food. Well, for some, it's just relief of hunger. Maybe it's promoting health and illness types of things. But it's also an expression of care. So when I get invited into someone's home, then and they are offering me something to drink and or eat, that is an offering of hospitality and love and caring that we sometimes miss. It can, of course, be celebration for life events, both positive events and negative, right? So weddings versus funerals. And again, what I just had mentioned, who gets that choices portion, who sits where, and it really is important when we think about the cultural meaning of food. And then when we think about what's prohibited in certain areas, so when we were in India, we were in a veg area, so it was all veg all the time, except when we got a craving for some meat, we would go over to the Muslim part of town because they had some really good mutton. It was delicious. And but most of the Hindus, no meat, right? And so that is part of their cultural practice, understanding that. And then even here, what is one of the things you guys see numerous times, a couple times anyway, on these lists?
Pork.
What are gelatin capsules made out of? Anything with gelatin in it? Pork and other animal byproducts often boiled down to make the gelatin. What's one of the first things we give those patients back to eat when they can eat?
Jello.
Who knew that marshmallows had gelatin in them? We give them Jello. And if they don't eat pork, then we wonder why they might not want to have that Jello. But we also are giving the medicines in gel caps, which might be why we want to open up that gel cap, put it onto some applesauce or something else that they could eat, right? So even here, wherever we are, thinking about these types of things is really important in that every encounter might be a cross-cultural encounter, no matter where we are. So, all that to say, what do you guys think? Are short-term missions good or bad?
Good.
They can be good. In that book by Greg Seeger, the one that's free that I told you about, he talks about how to do things well. And I'm going to touch on some of that, but it really is important to do things well. So here is what we often go into, our different cross-cultural mindsets. I'll give you a second to look at this map. Stereotyping. We all do it. I love that Texas is all by itself. It is the Lone Star State. You're absolutely right. But isn't it very true that we look at different areas of the world, wherever we might be, and we think, oh, yeah, Australia, it's all about kangaroos, maybe some koala bears. And all there is in some of the African nations, perhaps, is elephants and lions, right? Well, no, there's people, there's fellow image bearers of God in all of those places. And by the way, this image is available online. I just found it in I just love it because it really does illustrate stereotypes, how we stereotype people, put them into categories that perhaps, you know, it's not all about noodles in Thailand and Cambodia and Vietnam. They do have some really good noodles there, let me tell you. But it's not all about the noodles, right? But what's important is this idea of cultural humility. And being able to go in, we have an idea that our way is the best way. No, our ideas are not necessarily the best way. We also think our way of acting is the best way. And it can be a real barrier to being humble and going into those different areas. So humility is an ongoing process where we self-reflect, mentioned that already, on our own beliefs. And Elmer, Dwayne Elmer has some good books on servant leadership and that kind of thing. And he talks about that missionaries and those working cross-culturally could be more effectively ministering the gospel of Christ if they did not think they were so superior. So again, it goes back into our motivation. Why are we going? Why are we serving? It's not about us. It's about Jesus. And so being humble is super important when we think about that. And it really is important to understand what is it that we're seeing and be able to show honor and respect to people and look for those opportunities in those different situations. Being sensitive to language, being aware of what's going on, that situational awareness of what is going on, who sits where and where you've been designated, perhaps who eats first, what are the roles within those situations, and then behaving in certain ways that are best. This particular diagram from InterVarsity is one, it's called the entry posture diagram from InterVarsity. And I love this idea of let's stay on the green area, right? Let's be open and accepting of those differences because we want to establish that trust. We want to listen to people and their stories because there are going to be differences, right? We said it's not bad, it's just different. They're driving on the wrong side of the road. It's just different. Because if we go in with suspicion and prejudice and fear, we are going to alienate everybody. And if you're going in on short term, you're potentially going to jeopardize the long-term ministry if you go in that mindset, right? So you need to go in willing to observe, listen, ask questions, establish that rapport. That really is important. And again, we want to build those bridges that has been already mentioned earlier in a variety of ways. So that if we can do that, we will have a much better deepened relationship, even if we're there for a very short period of time. We don't want to live in that middle area. I'm going to talk briefly about culture shock. There will be some things that you think, oh, I'm not sure I can handle this. You know, it's like 100 degrees in Southeast Asia in the summertime, right? You walk outside and you're sweaty in 2 seconds or less. Maybe right outside the shower, if you've taken a shower. But you learn to get through and overcome with the Lord's help, of course. So there's a Harvard study out there that looked at implicit bias and what our implicit biases are. And sometimes we don't even know what our implicit bias might be. And so the Kerwin Institute, if any of you are interested, through Harvard, they have some great questionnaires that look at implicit bias and what that might look like. So we have biases. Again, we don't always know what those are. We may have some prejudices as well, and that's a perception. And then we make those stereotypes, very much like that picture that I showed you. But discrimination is actually the act of, we act on those perceptions. So they're separate ideas. We sometimes put those all together, but the bias is, okay, how do I view things? What is my prejudice? And am I putting people into categories? So, for example, I live in Southern California. We have a huge Hispanic population, which makes sense because we're close to the border. And if I think that Mexican families, for example, all have 15 kids, I'm stereotyping, right? But if I say, well, I know a little bit about Mexican or Hispanic families, and I'm going to go and ask some more questions, that's more like generalizing, not quite as unsafe. Stereotyping is not good. When we think, oh, I know about that. I'm sorry. I personally am never going to be culturally competent in a culture other than my own unless I either live there or, yeah, that would probably be the best choice, actually. But I can be culturally sensitive. I can be culturally walk in with humility in what we've been talking about. So let me give you an illustration, and this is, again, the Harvard website has more about this kind of thing that's kind of interesting and starts to get a little fascinating. Again, the educator hat is on. But the attitudes or stereotypes that affect our understanding are unconscious. So if I were to show you these three colors, so we have red, yellow, and blue, and I would just say my favorite color is blue. There's no judgment in that. I'm not saying the other colors are bad. I'm just saying that that's my favorite color, right? So that is my bias, if you will, toward a certain color. It's unconscious, perhaps. Some of you might think, oh, I like all those colors. But that means that we can have a favorable bias or an unfavorable bias. Some are negative in our biases and some are positive. So when we say that we have those implicit or unconscious biases, we're thinking about things that are outside our conscious awareness, perhaps. And it's harder to drill down into those and identify those. So it's an evaluation of our beliefs, etc. So even if I were to do this, fill in the blanks. Okay, what would go with Jung? What comes to your mind? Fill in the blanks.
Adult.
What else? When you see that word, Jung.
Old.
Right? So we fill in the blanks automatically. Our brain fills in the blanks. What about black? What would be white? Right? That might be an opposite. So our brain already is making associations with certain words. What about night?
Day.
Right? So again, we have our brain is super quick on making those jumps, those assumptions. We have those ways of thinking. Our brain is super quick. So that's what's fascinating. If you do go to the Harvard website or the Kerwin Institute, you can start to drill down on some of your biases. We have a colleague at CBU. She's married to a black man, and she's the one that did a lot of her doctoral research in this area. And she, even married to a black man with what you might call a mixed child or biracial child, had some implicit biases she didn't even know about and didn't view herself in that way until she had done some of those surveys. So let's read this paragraph together. Ready, set? If you can read this paragraph, it's because our minds are very good at putting together pieces of information in a way that is easy for us to make sense of. Our minds do this automatically and without our conscious control. Now stop and look at that again, right? Oh my goodness, isn't that amazing how our brains work? So oftentimes that implicit bias is just so quick. You guys were all able to read this. Our brains do that same thing. And so being mindful of that as you're interacting in cross-cultural situations is very important. So again, cultural awareness versus cultural sensitivity. So having that appreciation for that different group, being sensitive, using the correct language. So for example, where do we use honking horns and it's okay?
Australia?
Wedding. Bangladesh. Absolutely. India, yeah, there's lots of places, and then other places, Mexico, there's, and it isn't necessarily get out of my way, it's sometimes just, I'm right next to you, don't come over into my lane. Oh, wait, we're not using lanes. It just depends on what country that you're in, right? And so honking horns can be, being aware of that. Business cards. So when you hand out a business card, what is the way that you do that? There's some places you hold it in two hands to hand over your business card. That's a cultural difference. You might hand it over this way and you're supporting your other arm. Something you might not think about. How do you greet and or hand out business cards? You don't cross your legs in certain countries. You don't show the bottom of your foot in certain countries. You don't touch the top of someone's head in someone's country or in some countries in Asia as well. So thinking about that is important. And tipping. We don't tip in all countries. Just depends, right? So thinking in that way is very important. So finding out about the ethnic groups that are there is important. So this particular gal is a Karen, the long-neck Karen. But when I train the students to go, for example, to Thailand, but again, go different places, look at all the ethnic groups that are there. There's this tendency to think that in that country, oh, it's not that big, they all speak Thai. Nope. Each one of those groups, there's Northern Thai, Central Thai, and they're different, what we would call tribal groups. So in the Thai, there's Northern Thai, Central Thai, like I said, Southern Thai, and then Northeastern Thai. Those are all different groups. The next group is actually from Cambodia. They're mostly refugees from that particular area. The Karen are from the hill tribes most of the time, from Burma, so they cross the borders. Malays is more toward the south, down toward Malaysia. There's Chinese, there's Hmong, which actually came from different parts of the world as well. And I could just go, there's not even all of them listed here. Lua is not listed there, I'm realizing right now. So finding out about wherever it is you're going, what are the groups, the ethnic groups that are there? And then what are the religions that are there in that particular area? So it might not just be, so for example, in Thailand, this is the example I'm giving you, but they'll say that they're Buddhist. The king has to be Buddhist, but they have all of these other faith traditions as well. Especially as you get toward the south, you're going to see more of the Muslim faith tradition, but then there's the others. Too. When I go to Bangladesh, for example, it's a Muslim country, but there's pockets of Hindu faith and some animistic practices as well. So understanding that in that cross-cultural context is really important, and understanding the do's and the don'ts, the etiquette. So we're talking about how do you go into these places without causing what we would call cultural distress. So respecting all the images of Buddha. Buddha comes in all sizes and shapes. Buddha's green, Buddha's red, Buddha's rotund, Buddha's thin, Buddha is all kinds of shapes. Depends on where you are and what country you're in. Always have to remove your shoes when you're entering certain buildings, people's homes. And then, how many of you have served in Asia? Raise your hand. So a few of you. So if I were to do this with my hand, that is the same as calling the dog, which is offensive. So most often in many Asian countries, you turn your hand over and you call this way. Come on, guys, let's go. And for us in a Western culture, that might be a little odd, right? We're calling this way. So I start doing that when I come back as well. But again, the head is a sacred place. They feel like the spirit might live there. That's why you don't touch them there and some of the other things. And if your money, let's say your money here in the U.S., you drop a quarter or something, although nobody carries any change anymore. But if you were to drop a quarter on the ground, our tendency would be as it's rolling away to do what?
Step on it.
Step on it. Make it stop. If you do that in Thailand, you could be put in jail because the king's image is on that piece of money and you have just offended the king. Simple things that we might not think of. So again, thinking about if you're going to a cross-cultural context, what does that look like? And what is the worldview? I don't know if you remember from that iceberg, which was 15, 20 slides ago, but worldview was way toward the bottom. So when we think about worldview, it's that vision of life or set of beliefs that we look at the world, and it's that way deep down into the cultural piece. So some definitions. There's lots of definitions out there for culture and what that looks like. It's like an operating system on a computer. I think about two-year-olds. I do have three of my grandkids living with me, and the 2 to 3-year-olds, maybe the 5 and 6-year-olds too, think that they are the center of the world, right? So thinking about that when we think about worldview. So how is our worldview like a pair of glasses? What does that look like? It's how we see things, right? So I could have pink colored glasses on. You all could have green or purple or whatever. That is how you view the world. That is how your patient views the world. That is how that person that you're interacting with views the world. And they might not be looking at the world through those same colored glasses that you are. What do you see in this picture? This is so fun to watch, people. Okay, first off, what you might see is a
frog.
How many of you see a horse? I should say, how many of you do not see the horse, perhaps? Okay, if you turn your head, which way would you guys be turning? You'd be turning, yeah, to the right. You're right. So if you look, there's a horse in there. So the horse is looking up. So where the frog's eyes, that's the muzzle of the horse. And then his ears are what the frog legs look like. And his eye. And then his mane is down in the water. So the horse is looking up. So if you turn your head to the side, you can sometimes see that. It circles back to our worldview of how we view the world. And how we make snap judgments. I saw the frog. Okay, well, what else is there? There's more to this picture than the frog. There's more to this person standing in front of you than what you see. That's the point of this. Okay, now those of you that got the handout when you first walked in, or you can do it on any piece of paper, what I want you to do for 2 minutes or so is draw a picture of where you see yourself, where you see God, and where you see the world. This is not an art contest, and you are not to judge your neighbors. So draw a quick picture. Stick figures are great. If I weren't attached to a microphone, I'd be walking around the room to look and see what your pictures look like. So I think I gave you some blank boxes on that handout. Or again, if you're using your other notebooks or what have you, you can draw there too. So what's interesting in this exercise is I teach in a school that's a Christian college, but I would say about a third or less of the students are believers. So when I have them draw this picture, I can see by walking around the room what their worldview is. I can see whether they believe that God is maybe way out there or that they don't believe in God. Some are great artists and they draw these great pictures of, you know, somebody holding the earth and God's part of them, in them, whatever that might look like. But if you want to know what a person's worldview is, have them draw this picture. It tells so much about what our perception is. And I know some of you are still drawing because you're using the other side of your brain right now, and that's great. But thinking about where do you see yourself? Thinking about your next steps for either short-term or long-term serving. Do you see God out there somewhere? Do you see God right next to you? Do you see God holding you in the palm of his hand? Do you see yourself on a journey? Do you see all of these, right? So, again, our worldview influences this, even something so simple as this. Where do we see God in our life? We've heard a lot this so far about people and their calling, and we're called to do X, Y, and Z, whatever that is. And a friend of mine, Jeff Lewis, would always say, sometimes we mix up calling. We are all called to follow Jesus. That's the big C. And sometimes the little C is our discipline, nursing or medicine or fill in the blank. Architecture, whatever it is, right? The little C are the tools in the toolbox that we have to do what God has called us to do, to follow him wherever that might lead. So thinking about that and where your next steps might be and what that could look like is important. Now in the other box, just real quick, draw a tree. Draw a tree with some roots, a trunk, some branches, some fruit. Again, stick figure tree style is fine. Nothing fancy. So thinking about a tree, now let's think about labeling that tree with four things. Where would you put beliefs? Where would you put values? Where would you put behaviors? And where would you put consequences on your tree? So beliefs, values, behaviors, and consequences. Where do those consequences go on your tree? What about the values, beliefs? I did mention that self-reflection was important. That's what you're doing right now. You're doing some self-reflection. So again, in the interest of time, and if I were in a class, I'd be walking around. I can tell a person's worldview by how they label their tree. So if a person, how many of you put your beliefs toward the root system? Raise your hand. Did anybody put something else in the root system?
Values.
Okay. See right there, we have a difference in perception. For some of you, well, let's go on with the rest of the tree. Consequences, where'd you guys put those?
Fruit.
Anybody put consequences somewhere else?
I put it on dropped fruit on the ground.
Oh, dropped fruit on the ground. Ooh, that takes it to another level. Awesome. Yeah, I'll have to think about that. I like that. So we all might label our tree in different ways. So thinking about those of you that put beliefs at the bottom, in your perception, most likely, everything flows out of your beliefs. Right? Your values flow out of your beliefs. Behaviors and consequences would flow out of that. For those of you that put values at the bottom, everything flows out of your values, perhaps. But if I were to walk around the room, I'd be able to see where you land in all of those areas. That's your worldview. And even in here, we have some differences in worldview. Of course. Absolutely. She said the type of tree that you draw.
Because I'm from Michigan, and apple tree is
what. So we could have apple trees. We had all kinds of different trees. Absolutely. I've had pine trees because of California. We have some pine trees. Were you going to?
Oh.
Awesome. So sequoia trees, the root system is all connected, right? Mm-hmm, with all the other trees in the forest. Absolutely. I forgot about that. That's great. So, all worldviews start with some kind of a belief in something, whatever that might look like. Even non-Christians have a belief in something, and they hold fast to that. And so thinking about that is also something important as we look at how are we interacting with people that God puts in front of us. All right. Another question. Is the following true or false? All patients refer to illness and disease in the same context.
False.
Yeah, of course. So we, again, don't know what is going on with that patient, perhaps, unless we ask some really good questions. This picture was in Cambodia. That was our transportation. Did you look at the boat? It's kind of hard to tell, but it's kind of rickety. And we were going across the river and talk about trusting in the Lord that would get us across. Yeah, fun times. So when you think about worldview, it answers these questions. This is based on Sire. He did lots of research in this area. Does God exist or not in this worldview? So thinking about Islamic faith tradition, does God exist in that faith tradition? Yes, they call God Allah, right? In the Jewish faith tradition, yes. What about the Hindu faith tradition? How many deities? 333 million or some crazy number like that. And, millions of deities. Now, depending on where you are, they might have some main deities like Vishnu and Ganesh and others that they worship. But something to think about where your context is. Do they believe in God, yes or no? Naturalistic, biopsychosocial model, there's no room for miracles, there's no room for God. In our perspective, miracles happen. So understanding that is important as well. What is a human being? Are we a bunch of cells? or we created in the image of God, right? So that patient who thinks that abortion is okay might think that we're a bunch of cells. Just chemicals. When we die, we're done. Nothing happens after death. And so when we were in Bangladesh, we were doing a sanctity of life training. And the women there just think that when you have a baby growing inside you, that it's a bunch of cells. That's it. So we were teaching them about the sanctity of life. That is a person, right? Not just a bunch of cells or blood clot or something like that. Because if they have a miscarriage, that's what they see, right, that comes out. But it's more than that. So what happens to a person at death? We know with the Hindu and the Buddhist faith tradition, they believe in reincarnation, right? Other faith traditions, nothing after death. Of course, we have our hope in heaven. And then how do people know what's right or wrong? The peace child story, the culture dictated what is right or wrong. Here in the U.S., we have Judeo-Christian values that molded our laws. However, the culture is starting to shift and say that there's different things that are right and wrong. So what is that in the culture context where you are? And then, of course, what barriers in either nursing care or other care options would occur because of that. And then thinking about cremation that was shared last night versus burial. Some cultures need and want to be buried within 24 hours. What kind of ceremonial washing occurs? We think about Ebola. That was one of the problems with Ebola, is that they had ceremonial washing and they were getting infected because they wanted to wash the bodies afterwards. And so the Ebola kept rippling out and more people were getting infected. In Southern California, we have lots of celebrations with our Hispanic population that celebrate those that have passed away. And it's a way of grieving and mourning. So understanding that is important. And this last comment on the slide, in many places, doctors have replaced clergy. Because in our Western culture, we sometimes rely on doctors and medicine, and it's taken the place, perhaps, of some of those spiritual practices in some areas. So this also is thinking about how do we bridge the gap. Interesting, I had no idea what the first plenary was going to be about, but God obviously did. Thinking about bridging the gap and knowing that people are often resistant to types of change and bridging those without alienating people. Again, going back to the entry posture diagram. So I have on the other side of that handout, if you guys got the handout, there's two case studies. So I was going to have you do a little groupie thing, but in the interest of time, yeah, I guess maybe we could do some interaction on that too. So go ahead and read the first one about the Cambodian infant boy. Talk to your friends next to you. And what's going on in the story that had to do with culture, and what could you have done differently? So go ahead and just that first one about the little Cambodian boy. Talk to some of your friends nearby, new friends. So I hate to interrupt your conversations, because this is the best part for me, is watching you guys interact instead of just hearing me go blah, blah, blah. But anyway, so what kind of cultural things did you see in this scenario? Don't touch them on the head. What else? The strings. So in many cultures around the world, they would go, I think about Thailand and other places, they'll go to the shaman or whatever their healer, spiritual leader person is, and they will get literally strings tied on their wrists. They can be white, brown, red. Yep, seen red. Some places they actually tie some strings around the waist as well around the world, so it isn't just on the wrist. But when you see those strings, you know that that family went to a healer type person, leader within their clan or group, for either a blessing, for some kind of a protection, yes, to protect them from evil spirits, or something like that. So as a PICU nurse, we started IVs all the time, and so we would see those spirit strings, and as much as possible, try not to cut them. Right? So I'm sure you guys came up to that as well. Sometimes there are no other choices, and then you would perhaps have that conversation with that patient and cross that bridge if you have to, but maybe the other arm if there's no spirit strings. Now, sometimes you'll see patients. I don't think I have a picture. Hers doesn't. You'll see spirit like 15, 20 different spirit strings. They've gone numerous times for those blessings and or protection. And so being mindful of that, you know right away when you're in those cultural contexts that they have done that if you see the spirit strings. So, you know, in VBS and we do fun stuff. We'll make little wrist bracelets, you know, friendship bracelets with our kids and what have you. So I've learned that we don't do those anymore, especially in those contexts, because any little tied on wrist thing is in their culture a spirit string. And so even taking this to that next step of if I'm in a cross-cultural context and they have little spirit string thingy bods on, I need to be careful of what I'm wearing too, to not buy into whatever that cultural context is. So we have that, and then we have the IV and the scalp. I mentioned earlier a lot of Asian cultures feel like the spirit resides in the head. And if you make a hole in there, you've allowed the spirit to escape. What's interesting in that is trying to teach in the midst of that, right? We want to educate. We want to do things counterculturally, which can be a huge challenge. I think about when we were in Cambodia, we were doing CPR training. We were working with boat people. They literally live on boats. They have no home, no nationality. And we were teaching CPR. Well, their culture is if a child falls into the water and drowns, they leave them there because they feel like the spirit will sometime in the future return to that child. We, of course, know the child will most likely die if they don't know how to swim. So we did this training, the CPR training, and told them how to pull the child out and do CPR. And sure enough, we find out a month or so later that that happened. A mom counterculturally fished her child out of the water and performed CPR, and the child survived. So interesting when we start thinking about what are the cultural norms in this place where we are, and if we're doing some teaching, how is that going to rub up against their culture and their mindset and their worldview? All right. Another few minutes, we'll go ahead and look at the Vietnamese man. So we'll look at that case if you haven't already. So again, I hate to interrupt. You guys are having great conversations. But thinking about that cross-cultural experience, what is it you're going into? Whether it's in that patient's room down the hall in the U.S., or is it somewhere else? What are the expectations? And if we don't ask really good questions and find out about their worldview and our perception, we might not understand that in this particular family, what was the consideration? It was an end-of-life situation, right? So, and taking him off the ventilator, we would just say, okay, he's got no brain activity, it's time to take him off. And the family said, no, wait, it's not a good time. And in our Western mindset, we might not understand what that means. But dates and numbers and so many other things are so important in cross-cultural contexts. So in this particular situation, according to their person that they probably consulted, it wasn't a good time. You have a question?
No, well, actually, question and comment. What we talked about in our little group here is the fact that they nodded in understanding and left and quietly left the hospital. So that we made the assumption, well, we assumed that they understood by the nodding.
Correct. Yes.
And in actuality, what did the interpreter do? The right, say the right things? Tell them the way it was?
Yep.
Or did they do like we do and just nod because that's the polite thing to do?
Correct. And so we didn't really talk about that with communication, but that is huge, and thank you for bringing that up. So oftentimes, let's say I'm doing a history on my patient, and I'll say this. Now, guys, look up at my head. You're taking medicine, aren't you? Or you're taking your blood pressure medicine, aren't you? So in a culture that especially honor, shame cultures, it's going to be really important. They don't want to dishonor you. So, of course, they're going to nod with you, even if they have no clue what you're talking about, if they don't understand, if you don't have that interpreter, number one, that's super important. But oftentimes, yes, they are going to agree with whatever is going on. And this particular book that I got this out of, you see the top of the page, it says Caring for Patients from Different Cultures. And she's one of the first ones that had some really, she used to have free stuff online, now she's got it in a book, super smart. But these cases of these types of things. Now, most of her cases do happen here in the U.S., but of course we could use them in a cross-cultural context as well. And understanding that gestures and nodding and some of that might be in agreement. You're the authority, you're the power person coming in that context as well. Did you have a comment?
Even here, we
absolutely
might not want our caregiver to know that we didn't follow.
Exactly. So yeah, really thinking through that is important. And then for them, it just wasn't a good time. But a week later, it was an auspicious and good time for him to die. So important. Well, thank you guys for going and working through those case studies. Again, what I would refer you to if you're interested is going to that book. There's tons of case studies. But let's circle back to training and thinking about, okay, we're going to go on short term. What else do we need in our toolbox? Well, we need to think about safety and security. And yes, there's cobras in Thailand. Not really thrilled about that, and especially when I go up to the hill tribes and we see those snakes. I showed you that picture earlier. That was not a cobra, by the way. But the first thing, again, referring back to when healthcare hurts, is do no harm. There's so many stories of, and he has some stories, Greg does in his book, about, you know, you go in and you do that health clinic that you set up and you give the mom who's got 15 little kids running around, or even five, and you give the medicines in a little baggie that's unmarked and they don't read the language anyway, and they go home and one of the kiddos ODs on the meds because they just took them all. That happens here too. You know, you need to think about language. I can't tell you how many times patients would come into the ICU because the mom was giving 5 mls instead of 0.5 mls, right? And now you've got a toxic seizing child. So thinking about that wherever you're going to do no harm, not create dependency. And then your own personal safety, of course. My students always say, what are the shots that we have to get? Well, you need to probably get typhoid. For some areas, it'll be yellow fever. It just depends on where you're going. Do you have to take the anti-malarials, all those kind of fun things? We often will take the anti-parasite medications at the end of the trips because we do get fed some pork along the way, and we know pork can carry trichinosis and some other fun things. Those can all travel up to your little brain, and you can have seizures and calcification and all kinds of bad things that I've seen patients with, right? So we don't want that. We do treat after the fact. But thinking about that as you're going, what kind of buddy system are you going to have? We go to the night market, for example. It's fun. It's a cultural experience. But you need to always be with somebody and be mindful of that. And then how we dress. We are very, very conservative. So I mentioned in Bangladesh, we dress in the traditional clothing. I am covered to the tips of my toes and all the way out my wrists, and I cover my head. We are mindful of the culture. When we're in Thailand, we don't wear short shorts. The other tourists, it's hot outside. They're running around in little tank tops and short shorts, and we don't. Because we're going into villages, they don't dress that way. So we are very mindful of how we are in that. And thinking about if there is a disaster, where's that rally point? Where are you going to meet if there's an earthquake or something like that? So having those conversations before you go is key in the training for those short-term opportunities. And then this is what an average day for us would basically look like. Pray before every outing. We're sitting in the car. We're literally praying because when we go out of our compound, especially in Thailand, if you go to the right, within 2 minutes, you're going windy, 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 windy up a hill. So if y'all get car sick, you need the Dramamine or Bonnie, whichever. But we pray before we head out on those outings. And then we go into the people's homes when we are invited and pray with them. Sometimes we bring gifts because, again, in the Asian cultures, that's very expected, and it's usually some kind of food thing. Learning language, I mentioned earlier, it is so important because you can understand some of the nuances of the culture when you learn language. And we always get to learn how to make food. Somtom is one of the favorites. It's sweet mango salad. It's delicious. and anything else that the field workers have us cook. But then asking those questions, and we've been talking about that throughout this time, and don't make those negative comments about the culture, but be willing to get dirty and serve alongside the team. Now, I mentioned food earlier. I'm a foodie. And the Thai team, for example, the Bangladesh team, they all know I'll eat anything. I will try anything at least once. And I have eaten some fun things, and they'll just put it on my plate. Same thing happened in China. Here, eat this. Okay. Again, I didn't want to offend anybody, but I love food, and so that's not a problem. But try to do that, and serving alongside them, but debriefing every single day, especially if you're going on short term. You need to debrief the day, because there's going to be some really hard things. Jim Ritchie's here, and he talks about moral distress and moral injury and some of those types of things, that when you see those traumatic things. I still have a student from this summer that's coming by my office about every other week to talk about, that was so hard when we went into the slums and we saw this, this, and this. And processing all of that can be so important. And then doing fun things, of course, whatever those might look like, but then debriefing at the end. Debriefing is huge. That's also where learning and growth can occur, not just going through the motions and doing the task. The task, as you might have noticed, 15, 25 slides ago, was at the very bottom. You do all these other things first. You pray. You do some discipleship. Yes, there's a task, and you understand the culture, and you pray again, and you pray again. The task is important, but it's toward the bottom of the list. Being with people, that idea of shalom, right relationship with God and others, that's the most important thing. And yes, you might experience culture shock. Some of you might be familiar with this. You get there. Yay, I made it. Woohoo, this is fun, right? And then, oh my gosh, they do things different here. They're driving on the wrong side of the road. They're eating that, whatever it is. And interesting signs of culture shock, people start withdrawing. They start repacking their bags. They do all these interesting things while they're there. And you're like, they withdraw a little bit. So that's another reason that debriefing is so important, pulling people out, like, how was the day? You can even do something so simple as, what are your highs? What were your lows? Well, it was really hard to deal with this. But I saw God working in this. And really emphasizing that is so important. And as you come back, there will be re-entry. But it really comes back to head, heart, and hands. And Peter Sills wrote a really good book about this. Because this is what we're trained with, right? Science. It's all about science, which is important. But there's more to it. That's the head knowledge. We definitely need the head knowledge. So we need to understand how to do all these things. We need to know how to keep our patients safe. We need to be able to develop those partnerships. We need to avoid paternalism. That's that dependency. A lot of these places that you might be going, they were colonies at one point. And the good old savior complex of here we are to save you is still echoing a little bit. And so we need to be very careful of that. And don't cause harm and focus on those people. It isn't about you. It's about Jesus and how you can come alongside the work that's already been done. So, again, have we said prayer a few times, reading the word, discipling. You do need that academic preparation, whatever that may be, but the cross-cultural training is so important as well. And I would also, if I know a lot of you that raised your hand earlier in school, you're like, I can't read anything else. But if you read missionary stories, thinking about William Carey, that was one of the first ones I read, William Hudson, Taylor, and others, there's just so many stories out there. How did they do it? What did they do that was successful? And so that can be important as well. Having the right heart is also important. And again, I'm kind of zooming through these last slides, but the slides are posted for you guys to go back and take a look at. Thinking about what was shared in the plenary, stop being indifferent to the lost, the broken, and the shattered people that are around you. And show his compassion again wherever you are. Acts 1:8, Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, ends of the earth. Wherever it is that God puts you, that is so important. And be willing to get hot and dirty. It's okay. There may not be showers. Just depends. Touch the untouchable, like the story that I shared, just scooping up those kids and loving on them. And serve in any way that's needed. And my kids were in Ecuador serving, and they were building something, and they asked them to move a pile of rocks from here to over there. So they got an assembly line, they moved the pile of rocks, and then later in the day, guess what happened? They wanted the pile of rocks back over there, right? So while we might be healthcare providers and work in other disciplines, it might be that we're moving a pile of rocks, and we might have to move it again later. It might look different than what we thought when we go. So Micah 6:8, what is good? What does the Lord require? To act justly, love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God. That is our big takeaway, if you will. So again, don't pack your egos. It's not about you. It's about serving, that paternalism, but go with your team. Whatever, if you're doing short term, try to find out and meet that team ahead of time if possible. Keep that spiritual life going, if you will. And you need to understand culture. What is it that you are seeing? What are the behaviors? What are the activities? What's the meaning attributed to that as well? What values are important? What's their worldview? And that's some of that is from the perspectives course as well. So I'm going to not talk too much about reentry shock because of the interest of time, but it is real. When you come back, don't scoop up all your clothes and give them all to the Goodwill. Just don't do it. Just, you'll get there. Just adjust a day at a time. Debrief with people, like I said. And, yeah, this is our goal. And I believe that was shared earlier. All nations, tribes, people, language, worshiping at the throne. So a couple more things before I close out. We'll come back to that. So for more information about some ways to understand this biblical basis for healthcare missions, the history of healthcare missions, cultural considerations, and strategies, there's a course. There's a the QR code is up there, but there's also a little card that's on both sides if you guys are interested. One of the co-authors walked in a little while ago as well. But if you have any other questions, and then I have one more thing. Mary is going to come up and talk for a couple minutes. And again, I want to be honoring of time. We're just about done.
Okay.
Come over here so you can talk into the...
I'm a retired missionary nurse, 10 years in Papua New Guinea, 25 in Kenya, Africa, and started Tenwick School of Nursing. So when I retired, I developed a manual to help nurses know where they can go and serve. Because when I went 40 years ago, 50 now, I only knew of two or three places. So I have written all the hospitals, most of them downstairs or around here, and asked, do you need a nurse? What quality nurse? What do you need? And so I have 40 medical facilities that want nurses today, and I have your contact source, and I have 18 sending agencies, and again, they're here. But if you will take the QR code, and I have a business card with it, and you can take it and go, and download it, and you'll get this whole thing. And it's just, you know, I update it all the time. And then you go find where you're needed, and then you can go to that country, and you find what the hospitals look like. I have a page for every hospital. And so I hope it'll be a benefit to you, and that you will go and serve. Long or short term, both are needed. So I will go wherever she tells me to go.
Don't want you to
hurt. So I'm at the CMDA booth, and I'm where the coffee is. So if you want to take a closer look, you come and take a look.
All right, so again, it's like 12 o'clock, so I know you guys are all probably starving and tired of sitting. But if you have any questions, you can either come up to me and ask either one of us. But it's been my pleasure and honor to be part of this conference with you guys. Take care.
Thank you.